Hey there, you're listening to Unlimited Hangout. I'm your host, Whitney Webb. Longtime followers of independent or alternative media are probably aware of a tendency among some commentators to combine their criticism of Western politics and especially American politics with the belief that adversarial governments of the West, mainly Russia and China, are essentially the good guys, providing balance against the bad guys of the West. While it can certainly look that way at times, a key theme that I try to explore regularly in my work and on this podcast is about how the reality of the global power structure is based more in transnational networks that are less visible but more powerful than and transcend the nation-state. These transnational networks are based not so much on loyalty to a particular cause or a particular nation, but on manipulating the flow of capital for the benefit of the individuals and entities who compose these networks. In other words, the real power brokers of the world manipulate our reality and our politics, not to benefit a particular nation state, but to enrich and empower themselves at the expense of the majority of the global population. And over the course of the COVID crisis, we have seen this reality become more obvious than ever before. Last year, I was joined by James Corbett to discuss how these networks, specifically a transnational oligarchy, play a key role in managing the U.S.-China relationship, as well as in the rise of China as the top global economy. In this episode, my guests and I will be exploring how this plays out in Russia, and we will focus specifically on the COVID crisis and Russia's COVID policies as case studies for how the Russian government and Russian oligarchy appear to be all in for the rollout of everything from central bank digital currencies, vaccine passports, the so-called fourth industrial revolution, and other policies that lead to a bleak future of technocratic serfdom. Joining me today to explore these issues and discuss his insightful and often humorous reporting is Riley Wagaman. Riley is an American journalist based in Moscow, and he has previously worked for RT Press TV and Russia Insider. He currently writes about Russia with a special focus on COVID-related issues at his Substack, Edward Slav Squat, which you can find at edwardslavsquat.substack.com. Hey, Riley, thanks for joining me today. How are things where you are?
Thanks so much for having me. It's quite cold and wintry here in Russia, as you might expect, but things are otherwise okay.
Okay, well, that's good to hear. Well, as you've noted in your reporting, and as I'm sure many listening have probably noticed as well, there's a lot of information circulating and has been throughout alternative media on most other COVID vaccines, Moderna, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and so on, but there hasn't really been a lot of critical information or really much at all on Russia's Sputnik V vaccine, as well as those produced by China, like Sinovac's CoronaVac vaccine, which has been the most widely used where I live in Chile. Well, I think this may owe to language barrier issues, maybe a lack of China and Russia-based reporters looking to do this kind of work as well. There have been some outlets, as you've pointed out, that instead claim that any criticism of Russia's or China's vaccine is essentially due to racism or Orientalism or Russophobia or xenophobia, things like that. But frankly, your recent work has covered numerous reasons, numerous causes for concern about Sputnik V. And one of the striking things I learned from your coverage is that, just like Moderna and BioNTech, Sputnik's alleged developer, the Gamaleya Center, had never been able to make a successful vaccine until COVID, and they were also facing some major financial issues, or at least one of their main investors was right before COVID emerged. And I had recently covered in a series Moderna's pre and post-COVID situation. And my main takeaway from that research was that Moderna's COVID vaccine is basically a giant grift, one that threatens public health, of course, in a big way, given the mandate situation and so on. And you argue that the Gamaleya Center's Sputnik V vaccine is essentially the same in this regard. So could you tell us a little bit about the Gamaleya Center, why you think it's odd that they were chosen to develop Russia's state-backed COVID vaccine, and key points that concern you about it?
So probably people are familiar with the sort of approved Russian government approved narrative, which is basically the way that Sputnik V was developed so quickly. And recall that it was the world's first registered vaccine. That's what they call it, even though the Chinese had one that they were messing with earlier. But whatever. The way that they explained that this was possible, just rolled out something like 6 months. From announcement to registration was that they claimed that the Gamaleya Center had successfully developed this viral vector platform, and it was just sitting on a shelf, and they just, dusted it off, did their little thing, for COVID, and voila, you have a new amazing safe and effective vaccine that's ready for mass inoculation. The problem with this narrative, well, there's many problems with it, but one of the most obvious problems with this narrative is that this platform that they claim to have developed has n never is totally unproven. It is they have this platform, this viral vector, this adenovirus viral vector platform has never actually been used to create a vaccine that has actually gone to market. And interestingly enough, a lot of critics of Sputnik V claim that the V actually stands for five, like a Roman numeral, because Gamaleya's four previous vaccines all failed. They never went anywhere. And it's quite startling that this reality is never discussed. And like you mentioned with Moderna, I mean, Gamaleya doesn't really have a good reputation before the rollout of Sputnik V. Interestingly enough, what Gamaleya does have, Gamaleya, by the way, is basically controlled by the Russian Health Ministry, is that it has very close connections to sort of the most infamous Russian oligarch, this guy, Anatoly Chubais, who teamed up with Gamaleya in, I believe, 2008 or 9. And it was part of this initiative that Chubais had. He was put in charge of this state-owned company called RusNano. And this state-owned corporation was supposed to develop nanotechnology for the Russian government. They never developed anything. It was a huge scam. And in fact, one of the first vaccines that RusNano developed in partnership with Gamaleya ended up resulted in an embezzlement scandal. So that's the first viral vector platform
Fun.
result. Yeah, really fun, right?
That sounds healthy.
Yeah, exactly. Safe and effective. And it's just an amazing history if you go through it. I mean, I'll give you one, probably the most famous example that they always point to, ironically, is they claim that Gamaleya developed this viral vector-based vaccine for Ebola. And if you go on Sputnik's website, they praise this vaccine, this amazing viral vector Ebola vaccine. The problem with this vaccine is that it was tested on in Guinea right after Guinea had successfully eradicated Ebola. There was this outbreak between 2014 to 2016. And so right after Ebola had been eradicated, Gamaleya goes in. Test this vaccine on a few thousand trial subjects, I think 2,000 to be exact, and then we just never hear from it again. It's just shelved. They never ask for approval, emergency approval from the WHO. It only gets emergency approval from the Russian Health Ministry, which, by the way, operates the Gamaleya Center. And it's really interesting because recently one of the developers for Sputnik V, one of the scientists behind it, was interviewed by Forbes, and they said, "Look, you guys developed this vaccine, this Ebola vaccine that you always talk about, but has it actually even been used? Has it even like been used outside of Russia?" And she, this scientist lady, is like, "Well, no, it hasn't been registered outside of Russia, but it's just because there's never been an opportunity to use it." Which is actually totally false because Guinea had an Ebola outbreak in February 2021, and there was an emergency vaccination program. And guess which vaccine wasn't involved? The Gamaleya magic Ebola vaccine, which is repeatedly cited by the Russian government as proof of, Gamaleya's amazing accomplishments in vaccine technology. Anyway, it goes on and on. I mean, we're talking about a place this. Center, the Gamaleya Center, it doesn't even have, there was recently photos published of it. And so it's one of these typical Russian operations where the administration building is all, beautifully, redesigned and, nice new coat of paint. And then the other parts, the alleged vaccine building or one of the research buildings that a journalist snuck into, it looks like it was hasn't been touched since 1942. It's like looks like it's bombed out. And apparently this place doesn't even have an elevator, and there's just this whole, it's just so bizarre
Well,
that the
it's weird
Gamaleya
because
Center.
they've gotten all this, sorry, it's weird because they've gotten all of this money, right? Because of their to develop the Sputnik V vaccine, but they didn't really go into the vaccine production center of Gamaleya, as you mentioned in some of those pictures you're alluding to of I don't know if I'd say bombed out, but it definitely doesn't look like a place I'd like to visit. It's a quite dark and dingy looking, like a janitor's closet, but expanded into a whole building instead of just a closet. Yeah, so that what I wanted to point out, and you mentioned this in one of your articles for people listening, is that you noted that it's odd that this was chosen not just for the reasons that you've already laid out, but also because Russia in Moscow and in other places has institutes that have developed successful vaccines with a really good track record and really good international reputation that were not chosen to develop the vaccine. Instead, it was this one with no record of success. Ties to this questionable oligarch figure, and as you mentioned, his partnerships, or I guess the partnerships he sort of blessed between Gamaleya and Rusnano that he is running, I guess, have been tied to financial fuckery, for lack of a better word. So it's quite odd that it would go to them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, this, what's funny too, of course, about Russinano is, well, it's not funny for, the investors, but I mean, it's basically on the, it basically was on the verge of bankruptcy, and Chubais left Russinano, I believe, in 2020. So right around the time, even when they started developing Sputnik 5, he basically bailed. Because Russinano was just draining. I mean, it was a huge scandal. And now Chubais is the head, he's the special envoy for like sustainability for Russia. And he like this guy's a super creep. And he recently cited Bill Gates as this like great visionary for, climate change activism and things like this. Like Bill Gates is leading the revolution of sustainability. That's what Chubais is doing now.
The climate change stuff Bill Gates is leading, I've talked about this. Well, it's also Mike Bloomberg, a couple billionaires, and the central bankers. I mean, it's basically a giant financial scam. So it's something that someone like Chubais would probably be very interested in,
Exactly.
based
He's
on
really
his
good.
background.
He's good at finding
Yeah.
scams.
Well, that's good. Well, one thing that you brought up that I found really just nuts. And I'm really surprised I didn't hear about this before, is that apparently Sputnik V is the Russian vaccine. We assume that it was not just developed in Russia but is also produced there. But apparently Gamaleya isn't producing the vaccine. Instead, they're buying a massive amount of it, of the doses of the vaccine they ostensibly produce, and I guess people assume that they were tied to manufacturing. But instead, it's coming from a foreign supplier, apparently foreign anyway, and it's not named in government contracts. Can you discuss that and its implications a little bit?
Yeah, so there are several sort of approved manufacturers of Sputnik V in Russia, and one of them is the Gamaleya Center. So Gamaleya is supposed to be manufacturing its own, for lack of a better term, brand. And what's really interesting is that instead of manufacturing it, they're buying doses from an unnamed third party and just putting their name on it and selling it to, the regions or wherever these doses are going. So they're basically acting as a middleman, and purchasing the doses of their own drug from an unnamed third party. Now it could be, to be fair, it could be one of the other manufacturers and they just don't wanna, it could just be some sort of basic, grift going on, something like this. But who knows? And some of these contracts are written in US dollars, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, well, if it was a Russian domestic manufacturer, right, it would not make a lot of sense to use dollars for the contract. It would make sense to keep it in the same currency as the people paying it, right? So, That implies it's a foreign supplier, which I found.
Yeah, so it's super sketchy. It's super sketchy, and what makes it more sketchy is that this is another aspect of Sputnik V, which nobody, well, very few people talk about, or and I think not people are very aware of, which is that the Russian government has partnered with Big Pharma during the whole from since day one, basically. To get Sputnik V off the ground. Specifically, I mean, they've been working with Pfizer and Moderna, but specifically, they signed this memorandum of cooperation with AstraZeneca. And what's interesting is that Alexander Ginsberg, the director of the Gamaleya Center, basically just says that Sputnik V has no significant differences from AstraZeneca's shot.
Is that because of the adenovirus vector?
Right.
Because that's okay.
So I guess that the technical difference is that AstraZeneca uses like a monkey virus or something, you
Yeah,
know, as the
chimpanzee
transporter of the genetic
adenovirus.
material.
Yeah.
Right. And then Sputnik 5 uses human adenoviruses. That's what they claim. But what's really interesting is that right at the beginning of this whole process, so we're talking about I'm trying to remember now. It must have been June or July 2020. The Russian Direct Investment Fund, which is the Russia's sort of like government-run investment fund, they and sorry, and funds is the main financier behind Sputnik 5, invested in this company called R Farm. And R Farm has contracts with AstraZeneca to produce AstraZeneca in Russia. And R Farm also produces Sputnik V, and they're both produced and manufactured in Russia. And in December of 2020, Russia signed this cooperation agreement where they talked about, you know, combining scientific forces, investments towards a common goal. It was this huge thing, and even Putin sort of hailed this as this amazing, agreement for cooperation towards protecting, you know, global health and so forth. And you, if you look at this relationship, it's so bizarre. And you can find these Reuters reports talking about how the Russians turned to AstraZeneca for all sorts of logistical issues, like basically, you know, how to mass produce Sputnik V. And it's just very strange how incestuous it is. And you never really hear about how closely the Russian government is actually working with allegedly their competitors. And for example, another example of this is in August, last August, so August 2021, in Argentina, they administered Sputnik V as the first dose, and then they had a shortage problem. They ran out of the Russian shot. So it started administering Moderna as the second dose. And the Russian government, or sorry, the Argentine government said this was due to supply shortages. But then the Russians came in, the head of the Russian Direct Investment Fund gives this quote saying, "Oh no, this was always our idea. We always wanted to mix Sputnik 5 with AstraZeneca or Moderna or Pfizer. This was always our intention. We believe that this will provide more protection than just two doses of Sputnik. We are totally 100% endorse mixing our vaccine with big pharma shots." And it's quite extraordinary. And so I really feel like this whole vaccine war narrative really lacks nuance and is sort of made for TV. And it's clear that all these guys are just, you know, they're cool with it.
Yeah, so that's really interesting to me that it was, always the plan to combine Sputnik V with the other COVID vaccines, this whole mi mix and match thing, which obviously, in a sane world, the mixing and matching would be like tested to see if, I don't know, over a longer period to see what happens, but it's just like, they've essentially said that also in Chile too, not just in Argentina, and I think in some other countries. Too, they essentially like promote mixing and matching as like better
Yeah,
or
yeah.
good. Yeah. I think it's odd too that there's essentially this narrative that you've referred to That essentially the Sputnik V is like the Russian government vaccine. It's portrayed, at least in English speaking alt media or independent media, essentially as being like a public sector venture, not really tied to big pharma, and is sort of framed as or at least Western big pharma, yeah, and is sort of framed as superior in that sense for the people that tend to view sort of as I mentioned in the intro, sort of these adversarial governments to the West as the good guys, and it's just sort of not really standing up so much with the reality of the situation. And one of the other people, so you mentioned that the biggest funders is this RDIIF investment fund of the Russian government,
Right.
right? So. But you've also noted that Sberbank, which is Russia's largest bank, which I guess also is I thought it was a private bank, but I guess it's essentially owned by the Russian state now to some degree, that they were also intimately involved with the rollout of Sputnik V in a lot of ways, and that's really significant, as we can get into in a little bit, for people that re remember my reporting on Cyberpolygon, the World Economic Forum. Exercise Sberbank, a subsidiary of theirs, was the co-host of that, and the head of Sberbank, Herman Greff or Graf, is on the board of trustees of the World Economic Forum and very involved with a lot of interesting agendas. And not only does Sberbank have an interesting connection to Sputnik V and its development and its subsequent promotion and distribution, oddly. But it's also Graf, Herman Graf, however you say it. He himself is also pretty intimately tied up with all of this. Could you go over that briefly?
Yeah, it's really, I mean, it's spooky. It's super spooky. So basically what happened was in February 2020, so we're talking about really a full month before COVID even really became a thing in Russia. And Hermann Greff spoke to the media and he said, "So I just want to let everyone know that my bank, Sberbank, is really concerned about what's happening with coronavirus. And so we have these two initiatives that we're heading. The first one is that we want to rapidly develop facial recognition technology that works on people who are wearing masks." So for some reason, this was a top priority.
That'll stop coronavirus.
Exactly. And the second thing he says is we're offering grants, we're offering money to scientific institutions in Russia to develop drugs to fight coronavirus. And so within a few weeks, Greff comes out basically, and it's announced that the Gamaleya Center is now working on actually a few different sort of Russian federal agencies and institutions start working on this vaccine. Now, what's really interesting is that Greff decided apparently to put all his chips on Gamaleya, and not only did Sberbank fund, they basically put in seed money or whatever you want to call it, basically an initial investment into Sputnik V's alleged development. They did that, but also Greff later comes out and claims that he was what he received the vaccine in April 2020, which would mean that he would be one of the first people in the world to get this vaccine. For example, phase one trials, which were extremely small, we're talking about a few dozen people, didn't begin until the second half of June of that year. So he allegedly got the vaccine several months before phase one trials even started. Another really bizarre thing about Graf's connection to this is that in May of 2020, Sberbank creates a subsidiary and a subsidiary company, and which is ch given the specific job of creating offering creates a project office to support the production of this vaccine, which later becomes Sputnik V. So Spare is now in charge of production support. Greff also later says in an interview that he helped with technology transfer involved with the vaccine. And this company that he creates, Immunotechnologies, sorry, receives exclusive rights to supply Sputnik V. The first 9 million doses of Sputnik V were distributed by Spare Punk. And if they got this deal through
Oh
an
man, the
allegedly a.
bankers just want us to be healthy, Riley. I mean.
It's literally a banker shot, which makes me it always makes me laugh when people are like, oh yeah, Sputnik V, it's like so safe and effective and different from the big pharma clot shots. It's literally a banker shot. Like in the most it'd be like if JP Morgan, like got the contract to distribute COVID vaccines. It's so weird. Oh, and by the way, Herman Greff is on the International Council of JP Morgan. So there you go.
Oh, fun. Well, for people listening, so they have an idea of like how this Greff guy thinks. I think it was a 2012 panel that you quoted that you included in one of your articles on Spurbank. And basically people were talking about it was a, I guess, a World Economic Forum meeting, a panel discussion on, it was called The Way Out from the Management Dead End, Wisdom of the Crowd or the Authoritarian Genius question mark. And apparently people on the panel had been talking about, cliche, I guess stuff that's cliche now, sort of from these types, things like crowdsourcing the future and whatnot. And then he intervenes and he says, quote, "You are saying terrible things. You are proposing to transfer power into the hands of the population. If each person can participate directly in management, then what are we managing?" And then he goes on to say, "People don't want to be manipulated when they have knowledge. What does it mean to remove the veil from the eyes of millions of people and make them self-sufficient? How do you manage them? Any mass control implies an element of manipulation." This is just a technocrat guy that doesn't want you to know anything because he's a better manager of your life than you are. I guess that's what he thinks. What's really crazy here is I've talked about a lot of times in some past interviews how basically, the vaccine passport system or the QR code system, which I guess was going to be sort of how that played out, or was the plan for it to play out, in Russia and all of that is a segue to this digital ID agenda that's been promoted by the UN for a long time, or the public-private partnership ID 2020, and also the World Economic Forum. And that Spurbank is really leading sort of on that front in the development of that sort of ecosystem, as it were. Which is why the that particular bank, and you can talk. I'd love it if you could talk about this a little later, about how they see themselves not just as a bank but as a universe of services, and all of this stuff because they're basically trying to be that, digital ID, gateway to literally every service you require, all under the one roof of Spurbank, having it be sort of like centrally, extremely centrally, controlled. But basically, this guy is the fact that he's so involved with the WEF and all of that stuff and digital IDs, facial recognition and all of this stuff on a, in a massive way, in a lot of these fourth industrial revolution sort of technologies and also in the vaccine, I think is pretty telling, since the vaccine's sort of being used to justify the imposition of a lot of these sort of technocratic and tech powered, control systems. And the fact that he, has a quote like that, where you can literally just watch those words come out of his mouth, I think is, it's a great case study for stuff that's going on, in other parts of the world that have gotten a lot of attention by alternative media. Not this has not so much. Which is a little odd too, considering, Cyber Polygon did. which of course is the World Economic Forum's massive crippling cyber attack simulation they've been doing for a couple years now. That's co-hosted between the World Economic Forum and in Russia. Essentially, the Russian Prime Minister, gave the keynote speech, I think, to the last one. Hermann Greff participates in that. I think he was on a panel with Tony Blair this last time. That's fun. That sounds like a room I'd love to be in. Two really crazy people that love digital IDs. But man, that's a little unsettling. So there's a couple different ways we could go now, Riley. So I guess before we get I'd like to come back to Gref and Sberbank and stuff in a little bit, because you've done some other articles on their sort of biometric creepiness and how they're targeting children. But there's also some other World Economic Forum related figures that are pretty intimately tied to the Sputnik V vaccine as well, besides Graf. So I don't would you mind spending a little bit of time going over those as well?
One of the really curious things about Sputnik V is that it really sort of is the, it's a perfect example of, if you're looking for this connection between the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset and how it connects, I think quite obviously to this, global, vaccine rollout that's basically being used to peddle, QR codes, what I like to call cattle tags. Sputnik V is the most obvious culprit here. It had the ties that Sputnik, the people behind Sputnik V have to the World Economic Forum are so direct and obvious that it would undoubtedly be like the prime suspect if you're looking for some sort of World Economic Forum vaccine connection. So we talked about Gref, who is a board of trustees member of the board of trustees of the World Economic Forum. Then there's this guy, Kirill Dmitriev, who runs the Russia Direct Investment Fund, which we mentioned earlier, Russia, the Russian government investment fund. And he, this RDIF funds is basically the main financer behind Sputnik V. Now, Dmitriev is a really interesting guy. First of all, he got his start. He's a Harvard-educated ex-Goldman Sachs banker who also worked for McKinsey and Company.
Ooh.
So these are, really patriotic Russian firms. And he was a World Economic Forum Young Global Leader in 2009. So I'm sure that everybody is familiar with this Young Global Leader form. And I think recently there's been this video floating around of Schwab bragging about, I think it's not new, but maybe a year or two ago, bragging about how all of his stable of young global leaders have infiltrated, all corners of the world and are now guiding, the globe towards a
Penetrated
bright
cabinets,
new.
I think, in
Yes, he
governments.
literally says
Penetrated
that.
is the
He literally
verb.
says that.
Yes.
Penetrated. Oh, it's so gross hearing that man say that
It's
word.
very
But
gross. I mean,
so
I just find Schwab pretty gross in general.
he's
But
such a
maybe that's just
cartoon
me.
villain. I feel like he's a troll. I feel like they chose him specifically just to troll us because he's something from a film.
Well, people
But
like
yeah.
Schwab and Zuckerberg, it's hard to look at them and be like, why would they roll out these idiots to be their spokespeople for it? But these people also have like massive egos, and they've, invested so much time, like the specific part of their little of their agendas and organizations and stuff, that they feel like they need to be the face of it. I think it's ultimately an ego thing, and they're so
Interesting.
disconnected from like how regular people are that they just don't realize how like clownish they appear to everyone. Maybe that's just maybe not though. I mean, maybe I don't know, maybe there's another reason for it, but they definitely are pretty cartoony.
Absolutely. So yeah, I mean, just to recap, so we got Gref, who Board of Trustees member, World Economic Forum, involved in funding Sputnik V, technology transfer, gets the exclusive rights to distribute it, apparently was one of the first people in the world to be injected with Sputnik V, allegedly, et cetera, et cetera. Then you have Kirill Dmitriev, who is heads, the, he's the CEO of the main financer behind Sputnik V. Then, of course, you have Miss Houston, who you mentioned earlier, who was in Cyberpolygon. And Miss Houston, I mean,
The Prime Minister, for
aside from
those that
just
don't
being the
know.
prime minister, who inevitably has some sort of involvement here, is credited with signing that alleged secret order that gave Spare Bonk exclusive rights to distributing Sputnik V, the first 9 million doses, as I understand it. And then there's the guy that nobody likes to talk about, but we need to talk about him. Vladimir Putin, the president of Russia, actually gave an address in January 2021 at the World Economic Forum. And that was when they were discussing the Great Reset. That was like the topic, they were talking about. It was a virtual, meeting, I guess. And so Putin uses this really important speech to talk about how he would like to see more COVID testing all over the world. He wants to see more vaccinations, and he basically gives this sort of very Putin-esque spiel. That's basically build back better. He says global and national economies have been obliterated by the pandemic. We need to ensure that there's long-term recovery, and make sure that we overcome social imbalances. And the way that we're going to do this is we're going to rely on state budgets and central banks. They will play a key role. So
Good.
here's Putin, who is very often worshipped in the alt media as this, guy who's about to, liquidate the fractional reserve banking system or whatever, like destroy fiat and return to the gold standard and all this stuff. And here's Putin
Yeah,
speaking at the World
that's
Economic.
not what's
It's not what's happening.
happening.
He's speaking to Klaus Schwab at virtual Davos summit about the Great Reset and saying we should build back better with central banks.
Yeah. Let the now that everything's been, the economy's been totaled essentially, let's hand it all over to the central bankers to build it back better. That's
Exactly,
great.
exactly.
Yeah, that's obviously really troubling, but essentially, pretty much every government is doing the CBDC thing now. Even Iran, which is often seen as sort of out of this club, I guess you could say. That the WEF oversees, they're even doing the whole exploratory CBDC, or for those that don't know, a central bank digital currency, testing and all of that. Very unsettling. For those that haven't listened to my episode on CBDCs with John Titus, I would encourage you to go back and do so because essentially it's a giant control system. It's not really a monetary system or a financial system. It's a control system masquerading as a financial system, is essentially what that is. And so essentially what we're seeing here and what you've laid out in the Russian case is that this is very clearly being set up domestically. And if you actually bothered to look at it, it's a very advanced. In Russia, so far, largely thanks to Sberbank, which has their Sber coin, I guess, which isn't necessarily the digital ruble, right? But it'll be interacting with that, and is going to be a big time digital currency within Russia once this gets rolling. And of course, you have this. We can talk about this later too. This all this stuff about going on about Ukraine right now and how Biden may drop Russia from the SWIFT system. That of course gives Russia a big opportunity to push this financial agenda even further by saying, "Oh, we've been cut out of the SWIFT system. Time to go to the digital currency system that doesn't utilize SWIFT." Digital ruble, the Spur coin, that'll be essentially foisted upon all Russians. And it looks like a case of the West, battering Russia in Russia, saying, "Well, here, look how resilient we are. We have these digital currencies to fight back against U.S. sanctions." But if you look at the bigger picture here, I mean, the U.S. is also advancing towards CBDCs. It's a central banker plan on a global scale. So, it sort of looks like it's an adversarial agenda, perhaps, but really it's it's they're all going to the same place at the end of the day, and it's definitely unsettling, especially it should be anyway for people living in Russia and people that oppose totalitarian agendas. And one thing I wanted to add while you were talking too is why these ties between Sputnik V and the World Economic Forum are so important, and that is because the World Economic Forum and top people there, including Schwab, have openly admitted, you can find this pretty easily, that the COVID-19 vaccine rollout is foundational for the rollout of the fourth industrial revolution, which again is a term that gets thrown around a lot now, but it's also a term that, not unlike the Great Reset, was coined by Klaus Schwab, who wrote the book on the fourth industrial revolution. And he is a Schwab essentially describes it as the digitalization of everything, but especially the economy and emerging of the physical and digital realms, with a focus on artificial intelligence and machine learning, replacing human workers in a variety of ways, but also, having them replace human interaction, things like the metaverse and stuff coming up in there. And so, that's, I mean, everything we've just talked about in this last little bit here is essentially proving that, that Russia is definitely a good case study for exploring why that COVID-19 vaccine rollout is so foundational. And moving along from that, I think now might be a good time to talk about Sberbank and some of this biometric stuff that you have explored in some of your more recent articles, if you'd like to go into that.
Yeah, so very tellingly, in September 2020, late September 2020, Graf comes out and he has this big announcement. He's like, "We're not Sberbank anymore. We're more than just a bank. We're just Sber, and we're this universe of services. It's a universe of services to what is it? Oh, and they're he's like, "This will help us accomplish our motto, which is spare, always there for you." And so he had
Following you, breathing
always
down your neck.
following you. And so Spare has this huge ecosystem. It's like Amazon, sort of, or I don't even know. They have like Spare Market, Spare Health, Spare ID, Spare Food, Spare Sound, Spare AI. And what they're really involved with, I mean, they're involved with everything now. But one of the most alarming developments that has occurred over the last year or so in Russia is that Sber has been very active in rolling out biometric like solutions, that's what they call them,
Quote
specifically quote
unquote.
unquote solutions for schools, for school children in Russia. And it's not, I don't think it's just Spare that's doing it, but they're one of the main drivers behind this. And for example, there are these videos of these distressed mothers who like walk into, the entryway of their child's school and find that overnight they had installed these biometric ID turnstiles, like in the entryway of their school. Like, what just happened? Like, where did this come from? Why did they tell us anything about this? The reality is that Russia, for several years, going back to 2019, has been open about how they want to basically tag all the children in the country. And the idea is, I think by the end of 2024, if I remember correctly, they want all schools in Russia to be you enter and exit by giving some sort of, biometric identification. And in Moscow, they plan on having this system throughout the city for schools by the end of this year. And it's already being rolled out in both in Moscow region and across Russia. And Spare has even been working testing systems where like you pay for your school lunch by giving a thumbprint, like things like this. And so what you have to realize is, people are rightfully really nervous about the introduction of QR codes in Russia, which is a whole topic. But the reality is that they're already, they're getting at you from so many different angles, and they're especially targeting the younger generation, the children. And I think that's obvious that they see this as the easiest way to make this transformation happen. Like if you just get them when they're young, you tag them, they get the biometric ID, and
You
this is how
normalize it for
normalize it
them
at a
more
young
easily.
age. Because otherwise, someone is, the older generation is like, no, I don't want to do this. This is creepy. But kids, you can get them when they're young. So it's very disturbing, and it's frightening. And you can go to these Russian internet forums and listen to these Russian parents talk about how, their kids are basically being tagged without their knowledge. It's quite extraordinary.
So you brought up the COVID QR system, and it seems like there was a lot of public pushback from that within Russia, and that was sort of going to be like the planned, I guess, vaccine passport system implemented in post-COVID Russia. But it seems like not only was it really unpopular with the public, it seems like it's actually been sacked, apparently, that particular initiative. Would you mind talking about what that system was, who promoted it, why it was so unpopular, and why you think that perhaps the victory, quote unquote victory of getting that particular code scrapped was a sneaky fake out so that biometrics could sort of come back in the back door?
Yeah, I mean, well, it's confusing because in Russia, they still have systems, regional QR code systems. So depending on the region you live in, you may not have any sort of interaction with QR codes, or they might be part of your daily life. So a good example of this is I'm in Moscow. QR codes really aren't widely used. You need them for museums and I believe like large events like concerts and stuff like that. If you go to St. Petersburg, they're ubiquitous. You need them to go to a restaurant. You need them to go to a shopping center. Basically, unless you're going to buy groceries or to a pharmacy, that's your only out at this point. Enforcement also varies. So there's QR codes at the regional level. What happened was that at the federal level, national level, the State Duma wanted to introduce a national QR code system, which would basically just make a uniform system. Everybody has the same rules, which for a time also included transportation. So that would have been a big one. And also, obviously, enforcement would probably be more standardized. So that was the original plan going back to mid-December. And this bill received tremendous pushback, like State Duma deputies, sort of your legislators here in Russia, were just bombarded, on social media with all these negative comments. There was all sorts of things, petitions and videos, and even some actual protests against this. And so eventually, I guess it was mid-January, the State Duma announced that they were just going to shelve this bill. Which was great news. And it was a great victory for the Russian people who made it really clear. I mean, this was honestly one of the most unpopular bills probably in modern Russian history. There are polls done, online polls, with like 1.4 million respondents, where 92% of people said that they didn't want this national QR code legislation. So the problem, though, is that QR codes are still widely used in many parts of Russia. And interestingly enough, right after the bill failed, Dmitry Peskov, the Kremlin Putin's spokesman, came out and said, look, we don't even really need this bill. Like the regions will just take care of, what they need to take care of. And so the way that they're approaching it, in my opinion, and I think there's a lot of evidence for this, is that they'll just get the regions to do what they wanted to do already, which is, normalize the existence and use of QR codes. And we're already seeing this, for example, in Moscow, where QR codes are not widely used. They've announced that they're going to issue QR codes to children who recover from COVID or who get vaccinated. So why would you do that if you're not going to be using QR codes in the future? Why would you give a child a QR code if you only need them for, almost nothing? So I really don't. I think it's way too soon to celebrate, QR codes going away. The most obvious reason being is that they're still here in Russia, and they can return at a drop of a hat all across the country at any time if they haven't already. So another thing that I wanted to say about this too is that there's this meme that Putin opposed the QR codes, which is absolutely not true. Putin publicly supported the national QR code legislation, and he said that it was his moral duty as president to support this bill. Of course, he gave some sort of song and dance where he said, "Well, but it should be like done in a way that's not too, doesn't inconvenience Russians too much, and blah blah blah, and it should be, it should be done in the right way." But he fully supported this legislation. So if anyone tells you that this was some sort of 5D chess move by Putin, they're just lying to you.
Well, that does seem to be the argument a lot when he gets behind one of these, I guess, I don't know, WEF approved initiatives, right? That, oh, well, he's doing it for reason X, Y, and Z. But people also said that in the US about Trump for a lot of stuff, and that wasn't true. That was sort of like the I don't know,
Yeah.
the I don't know if it was all QAnon people doing it, but it's sort of that same fallback of, 5D chess and whatever. And obviously, I wouldn't put Putin in the same category as Trump as a statesman. He's definitely more calculating, I think, and obviously a different type of figure. But I think, what's problematic, I think, is that, before COVID and stuff, it was really easy in cases like Syria or Ukraine, some of these proxy wars, to sort of see Russia and Putin as the good guys, because you provably have the West, the US specifically, going in and creating all this death and misery in places like Syria and the Ukraine by trying to do coups and things of that nature. But really what we've seen over the course of COVID-19, and for people that are opposed to the implementation of this digital ID system, this technocratic future, the fourth industrial revolution, whatever you want to call it, in terms of heads of state, there really are no heroes here. I mean, they're all essentially rubber stamping it all over the world. I mean, there's very few countries where that's not happening. I think maybe I've seen in Brazil, Bolsonaro, maybe he's been very critical of a lot of this stuff, but he's definitely not popular with international media for that, that's for sure.
Right.
And for people listening, this doesn't mean I'm a Bolsonaro fan, right? I'm just pointing out that he's like one of the very few people on the international stage have actually like pushed back against this agenda in any way. And I think it's really time to move past this sort of tendency in alternative media to sort of create certain heads of states to be heroes, and they can do no wrong, and they're really fighting for us, and they're fighting against the bad guys and all of that stuff. I mean, I think we have to let go of that and realize that anyone that's a head of state, or specifically someone like Putin, who's been a head of state for a very long time, there's a reason they're able to maintain those positions for so long. And because there's, as I've talked about, on this podcast a lot, and in my work in general, the real power brokers of the world are transnational. And it's about the flow of capital and all of this stuff. And if Putin wasn't playing at least some parts of the game to the liking of these guys, he something would have happened to him a while ago, I think. But people are welcome to disagree, but a lot of these agendas have advanced considerably, in Russia, and he hasn't pushed back against them. So, we'll
Yeah,
see what
no,
happens.
there's so many examples of that too. Just a really quick one on Putin is this is another really something that you never don't hear about, especially from the Sputnik V shills, as I like to call them. The people on the internet always talk about how great Sputnik V is.
Have they
So
gotten it, or are they just saying it's great because they're like, this is my favorite brand?
I think that's it. I think that's the reason. I think this. They think it's like the, anti-empire shot,
Okay,
whatever.
they'd buy the
So,
t-shirt but not take it. Okay.
Exactly. They got the t-shirt. They got the band t-shirt. So In the United States, how there's huge controversies about safety monitoring, but at least you have VAERS. At least you have VAERS in the United States. So VAERS is far from perfect, but it's better than nothing. Russia doesn't have VAERS. Russia has zero transparency when it comes to post-vaccination complications. The Russian government will not even release this data. In fact, they recently came out and said that disclosing how many people who have died post-vaccination would be inappropriate to disclose this data because it could harm what was they had a phrase, Juan. Oh, it would create a negative attitude towards vaccination.
Oh, that's the same excuse Patreon gave for censoring me because of factual reporting that they thought would promote vaccine hesitancy in my audience. It's true, but you have to go.
And then more recently, a Russian health ministry, a state Duma deputy, so like a Russian lawmaker, contacts the Russian health ministry and says, "Can we please see the most up-to-date Sputnik V trial data? Because it's been a really, really long time since we've seen any actual physical clinical trial data from you guys. The last thing we saw was like an interim report, which was only 6 months worth of data. We would like to see what you have now." And the Russian health ministry says this is classified information that's a trade secret, so we can't disclose it. And so we're talking about literally zero transparency on a coercive. There is compulsory vaccination in Russia, by the way, for those who might think otherwise. There is. So we're talking about zero transparency with a coercive mass medical experiment. And at the same time, Vladimir Putin goes out in front of the cameras and says, "Sputnik 5 is proven safe and effective. There has not been a single case of serious post-vaccination complications in Russia." Well, that's true because the Russian government doesn't disclose any of this data. So it's
Or
a
report them.
report.
Yeah. It's the same in Chile, where I live.
It's really gross and it's really cynical, and people should admit that Putin is not on their side on this issue. Like, okay, I understand people who believe that Putin, has things that are praiseworthy in the foreign, foreign policy arena. But on COVID-related issues, which by the way are really important, we're talking about the preservation of basic human rights and dignity, Putin has been terrible, just absolutely appalling. I mean, probably not the worst world leader, but the bar is, I mean, he's not a Trudeau, but Trudeau's sort of in a league of his own, but he's really bad. He's still really bad. So I
Yeah,
don't
he
know.
shouldn't be praised for
He shouldn't
it,
be praised. And a lot of
and
people,
it shouldn't be
it
ignored by
shouldn't be
people
ignored.
that
It should be
claim to be
praised.
holding, leaders globally to account. it's unfortunate. I definitely agree. All right, so there's a lot of you're very prolific and you write lots of articles, so there's a lot of different things that you touch on, and some of the stuff we have talked about. Or touched on already, but you have two articles that I found pretty interesting that aren't necessarily related so much to the vaccine, but more on this other, the underlying thing here, which has to do with this push to the digital economy that's been going on under during the COVID-19 crisis and all of that. So one of them is called the Central Bank Takeover of Russia. And then the other one is, why is Russia sending planes full of gold to London? Which is fascinating. Also very bad, but in the sense of fascinating that you have a lot of people who have very established reputations in alternative media and the independent media. Sort of what I mentioned earlier, the likelihood that the US will kick Russia off of the SWIFT payment system, which is like SWIFT, for those that don't know, is how banks essentially communicate with each other. So it would be sort of supposedly taking Russia off of the global banking system. Aha, but a new global banking system is currently being made by like every country in the whole world. So essentially it would be an impetus for Russia to, as I mentioned earlier, unfurl or unveil its own version of this new global banking system, the CBDC digital system. But a lot of these people, I think you include a tweet from Pepe Escobar saying that, oh, well, when Russia gets disconnected from SWIFT, they'll be making payments in gold and it'll be, the gold standard and all of this stuff, and that it's going to be a return to sound money. Sounds like the libertarians' dream there. But oddly enough, you point out that even though Russia's been making headlines over the past, I don't know, several years or so, decade, I guess, for stockpiling gold, now they are sending insane amounts of gold to London, where the city of London is, supposedly head of the banking cartel, right? They're sending it over there when this economic chaos is on the horizon. And why would they do that if they were going to return to a gold standard system or start demanding payment in gold? It seems like it's not what the central bankers have in mind.
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting policy term because for several years, I believe that probably the sort of prime years of this, sort of 2014 to 2019, Russia's central bank was stockpiling gold. I mean, buying gold quite aggressively, and they were basically one of the major customers for Russia's domestic gold mining enterprises. So, Russia is one of the major, I think top, I want to say top five, maybe even top three gold producers in the world. And they sold a lot of this gold that was mined domestically would be sold to the central bank. Now, when COVID came, the virus arrived in Russia. Just like everywhere else, there was like this total economic chaos and panic. And according, this is the theory that I keep reading on the internet, is that basically the Russian government was really short on cash. They needed to prop up various aspects of their economy, and they needed cash, and they needed it quickly. And so they, first of all, they stopped buying gold, and they even sold small amounts of their gold holdings. And this was one of the measures they took to combat economic repercussions of lockdowns and other suicidal public health measures. What's interesting too is people will argue, well, another reason why they probably didn't stop buying gold is because the price of gold shot up, like basically in April 2020. And that makes sense. I mean, if you have a whole bunch of gold and the price of gold shoots up, you probably want to start selling it instead of buying it. So that makes sense to me. And also people will say, well, I mean, this Russia Central Bank already has a ton of gold, which is true. I think they have top three or four reserves in the world. So those are all legitimate reasons to stop buying gold and to even maybe sell some of your gold. So I have no problems with that. The problem comes when you realize that Russia's still producing a whole bunch of gold, mining a whole bunch of gold each year. And what ended up happening was not only were they sending this gold abroad to be sold, primarily in London, which is, the main sort of precious metals market, but Putin later, this was pretty recently, I believe back in June, so June 2021, signed a law or an order of some sort that allowed Russia's gold miners to sell their gold abroad, and they don't have to return the cash that they make, the proceeds. They don't have to put it into a Russian bank account. So they can mine the gold, send it to London, and pocket, put, deposit the money in a Swiss bank account. And there you go. And so it's like this sort of, a disappearing act for Russia's gold, where a very small group of Russian oligarchs basically get to export all the gold, pocket the winnings, and Russia doesn't see a penny of any of it. And so one can obviously see why there's problems with this. Especially if you believe that Russia is heading towards this, gold-backed sound money future, which I don't think is the case. I think we're heading towards a central bank-controlled digital currency future or a Sberbank bank-controlled digital currency future. And so it's a very, very startling U-turn where you had a situation where Russia was aggressively stockpiling gold, and now it's aggressively sending its gold abroad to the benefit of a very few people.
Right. So what's really telling about how, as you said, this is either going to be a spur bank or a, digital currency future or a digital ruble future controlled directly by the central bank of Russia is that the alternatives, right, to the existing system, which is going to collapse at some point, right, is you have the gold, right? But now it's weird stuff is happening with the gold. But also you have the banning of Bitcoin and cryptocurrency take place relatively recently, right?
There's an ongoing debate about this. The central bank really wants to ban it. Some lawmakers don't. But yeah, they're deciding on these issues as we speak.
Right, but the central bank obviously doesn't want it because it would be competition for the central bank digital currency. And if it, you know, it will obviously be more appealing than a CBDC because it's not centrally controlled by the central bank, where it's essentially, you know, the same crap that, you know, as the current system, just a digital, you know. So, and then I think, in one of your articles on this topic, I think it's in the Central Bankers Takeover article, talking about how they have plans for transaction monitoring every every financial transaction, which is pretty telling as well in terms of the whole plan for CBDCs or Spur Coin and things like that. And you also have what was interesting going back to Cyber Polygon, which is we've mentioned a couple of times was co-hosted. Between Russia and the World Economic Forum, or rather, a Spur Bank subsidiary, and had a lot of involvement from Russian state leaders is probably the more accurate way to put it. But you have the deputy governor of the Bank of Russia speaking at Cyber Polygon, and he's talking about the plans for the central bank digital currency of Russia, the digital ruble, and he expressly says that. Where's the quote? He says, "This digital ruble will permit better traceability of payments and money flow and also explore the possibility of setting conditions on permitted terms of use of a given unit of currency." Which is basically the central bank decides what you can use your money for. They don't want you to buy, you know, they decide that sugar is bad for you. You can't buy sugary foods anymore, you know, as one example. Just so it's, you know. Not that that's exactly what they're going to do, right? But you know, it gives them that type of control. You know, Catherine Austin Fitz gives some pretty good examples in talking about this, where she says things like, you know, how some of the lockdowns, like in Australia, for example, you couldn't go more than 5 kilometers from your house. In the case of a central bank digital currency, if they don't want you to go 5 kilometers from your house, your money, your central bank digital currency won't work at local at places, points of sale more than 5 kilometers from your house, right? That's a pretty, I guess maybe a more feasible example, maybe for some people. And the head of the Bank of International Settlements, the central bank of central banks, as it's often referred to, Augustine Carsons, the comically huge head of the Bank of International Settlements, that looks like some of those old political cartoons of Wall Street fat cats. He literally is that. In real life. Yeah, he has a quote that's really similar to what this deputy governor of the Bank of Russia said, but he, you know, he cloaks it a little more in a way that's a little more confusing for I think most members of the general public, talking about liabilities of the central bank instead of talking about, you know, a unit of currency as this guy does. But he essentially says the same thing, that we can set limits on what types of purchases people can make. You know, and it's all a centrally controlled system. You know, this is giving the state or the banks rather or state banks a lot of power here in the case of the CPDC setup, and it's wow. I mean, it's really disconcerting, and it's really unfortunate that people are sort of missing the point here, especially when, as you referenced earlier, Putin gave this speech to the WEF being like, central banks will get us out of this mess. When in fact, one could argue that central banks have taken great advantage of this mess to enslave us all forever. Increasingly looks that way. So, one thing I wanted to ask about this is, you know, you have the Spur coin future and the digital ruble future. Do you think they'll be competing? Do you think there'll be a fight between the digital ruble and Spur coin for supremacy, or they'll exist co side by side, or do you have any expectations?
So the Spur coin I don't know where it is sort of in the development process. By the way, Sparecoin is being developed in partnership with JP Morgan. So that's a fun little, it's a little fun little factoid for everyone.
That's fighting back against Empire for sure.
Exactly. It's the anti-empire big bank digital currency, the Sparecoin.
That's what they'll say,
Everybody get
maybe. Yeah,
excited.
we'll see.
So I don't, you know, with Gref, who he's so ambitious, so who knows, maybe Sparecoin will never get off the ground. It's possible, but he's mentioned it before. I think he's going to go for it. I don't know where it is though right now on the sort of when it's going to be rolled out. That being said, the digital ruble is already being tested. It's already gone live. And my understanding is that they are starting to use it to issue pensions with, which is a really sneaky way of doing it because they're basically forcing
Yes.
old people who are dependent on the state, who are literally forced to use the digital ruble. They're like, all right, you want your pension? Here it is in digital form. The idea here is that the central bank wants to basically test to run the digital ruble on pensioners, which is really unfair, obviously, because you're basically coercing people who are dependent on the state to use this digital ruble to feed themselves. The problem with this plan is that in Russia, I mean, pensioners are not very tech savvy, and a lot of them don't even have, your debit cards. They don't even have those. They still use cash. So how are you going to get these elderly people to start using a digital wallet, on their smartphone, which they may or may not even have. So I don't know how, the thing with Russia, there's that famous saying, what is it? It's like the severity of Russian laws is alleviated by the lack of obligation to fulfill them. This goes back like hundreds of years where it's like Russia has these crazy laws, but you don't really have to follow them, And so the question for Russia is so there's this. It's just you have a situation where they're aggressively pushing these Great Reset, Fourth Industrial Revolution agendas in Russia. My belief is because there's just no real democratic oversight whatsoever. I mean, even the basics that, we take for granted in many Western states just don't even exist at a basic level in Russia. And so they can just push everything they want right through, and no one's going to do anything about it. At the same time, it's a country where people really are quite suspicious and untrustworthy. They don't trust the government, and so getting people to go along with these new systems is going to be a challenge, a very big challenge. So there's this strange paradox going on in Russia right now, where the government is aggressively pushing these really worrying, deeply worrying, sort of civilizational transforming measures. At the same time, Russians, I think, are going to really resist it.
Well, as a lot of what you described is also going to be going on in Chile, where I live in the next year or so. So there, the new president that's going to come in, supposedly a progressive, is how he's been portrayed. And maybe he used to be that, but I highly doubt that given what he's done during and since the election. But essentially, the guy that the head of the central bank under the supposedly right-wing fascist-y, according to the current president or the president who's going to come in, he's called the guy who's running the country now a fascist and all of this stuff, but he took the head of the fascist central bank and put him in his government as the guy who's going to be in charge of how to finance all of his stuff, including pension reform. And this is the guy that developed Chile's launching or white paper started that off for their for the central bank digital currency here in Chile, and they're going to be doing that on pensioners as well. And what I suspect, based on what we've been talking about today, and I think this is going to be the case in Chile as well, is that, how do you get around the fact that old people aren't tech savvy and probably don't have a lot of them don't have smartphones? Well, what you mentioned earlier with like the kids in schools, right? Paying for food with your thumbprint, they're going to be doing that for seniors too. It's going to be buy with your face, buy with your fingerprints, your handprint, and whatever. I think that's how they're going to try and get around it and sell it as convenience to older folks. It's at least it's what I anticipate them doing. Because like in Chile, for example, there was a the lockdowns here were really excessive and draconian, arguably
some of the most draconian in the world, at least in the top five, I'd say. And you had to have QR codes to even be allowed to go buy food that you had to generate online. And there were cases of, there was a woman who was 100 years old or something filmed being denied access to buy food because she didn't have a smartphone and couldn't get a QR code, and she didn't have like any grandchildren or anything nearby to like help her get one, so they were like, yeah, starved to death, old lady, because so that has happened here. And I think the way they'll get around that is going to be biometrics, unfortunately, which plays into this whole thing at the end of the day. Very unfortunate, but it definitely seems like the central bank digital currency, from what the people at the Bank of Russia have been saying, is well on its way to getting established. Whether Spurcoin ends up taking over or not seems like something to be something to be seen. But it's there's some really amazing quotes from this guy, and I didn't get to watch all of Cyber Polygon last year, so I missed this guy's speech. And I really shouldn't have. I mean, he says stuff in here like parents could give the digital currency to their children with certain restrictions, such as blocking them from buying junk food. And he's basically like, we can apply that to adults too, but with hundreds of different similar use cases. Yeah, I mean, it's just really blatant and unsettling.
It's remarkable how, this is, again, this is just another thing they're pulling on us, another fast one that's going to be totally life-changing. And there was, at least in Russia, there was obviously zero real discussion or debate on it. They just decided, like, oh, we just need to do this, so deal with it. And there's even there, I'm even starting to read people getting really panicked, like talks about like runs on banks, like we should just get all our money out of the bank. Like these people are crazy. They're gonna like make us force us to use this crazy digital currency. I think that people are getting nervous. People are getting nervous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't plan to use I know there were people, for example, with like the vaccine mandates who felt like they had to get the participate in the vaccine passport to continue their lives or feeding their families and stuff like that. But every step you take in the direction of this system, it's going to be harder to set up and develop a parallel system at some point in the future. And at a certain point, you'll cross the red line where it's impossible. And I think CBDCs are going to be that red line. Once you start to use the CBDC system, because, oh, well, that's how things are going, and how am I going to do this? I understand that, but they haven't been rolled out yet, and it's time to prepare now. And the more, we allow ourselves to participate in the rollout of this system, it'll just eventually become entirely impossible to do anything else. And it's very unsettling here. But it looks like in Russia too, and I'm sure it's going to be like this in other countries as well, that the CBDC setup is looking like it's going to be sort of like a public-private partnership, in a sense that it's not going to mean the end of commercial banks or anything like that. It's going to be commercial banks selected to use the digital ruble. They'll be chosen, and then certain authorized service payment providers will be approved to handle it, and everyone that's not won't be, so it looks like, I don't know. There's a lot of people that are like, as long as the state's doing it, it's fine. Or it's the public sector and the private banks aren't involved. But here you see it all mixed together. And, that's also true, as we mentioned earlier, or you mentioned earlier, about the Sputnik V vaccine. It has this people, for some reason, think it's just a an exclusively public sector venture, when in reality, you've talked about, the Kremlin Big Pharma Alliance, as you call it, and how there's a lot of inter cross pollination between these groups. It's woohoo, not good. So anyway, what do you think is going to happen then in Russia, huh? As far as the rollouts of this stuff, do you think people are going to be fighting back like they did against the QR codes, or where do you see things going?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely expect resistance, but I really do think that at least very large segments of the Russian government are really dead set on the same agenda that they're pushing everywhere in the world. So Russia's not special, guys. It's this, we got the same garbage is going on here. That's going on everywhere. So, obviously I want to stay optimistic, and if I, if I wasn't at least somewhat hopeful, I wouldn't even bother writing about this stuff. I would just run into the woods and leave you guys to, figure out things on your own. But no offense. But
No, it's fine. That's increasingly becoming my
I really
political
have
view. Run into the woods and say, figure it out for yourselves.
right, just run into the woods. Exactly. I got potatoes. Forget you guys. I have tremendous faith. I have tremendous faith in the Russian people. Really, like, just incredible, especially in times of crisis. And they're also just a really no bullshit kind of people. And I think especially now that the Russian government is basically coming after their kids in a very direct way, both with vaccinations and with tagging policies, bionodes. I would hope that, we're going to start seeing some major pushback, and the defeat of the national QR code bill is definitely reassuring. But like I said, I think there's a long, long road ahead of us, unfortunately. But just gotta stay positive, stay hopeful, hope for the best, I
Yeah,
guess.
that's definitely true. This is probably a weird anecdote for some people, but I have a 4-year-old, and I try not to show her too many new kid movies because a lot of them are pretty dumb. So we were watching the Never Ending Story, just from like 1984 or
Nice,
something,
nice. I know
something
that
like
one.
that. And and there's this scene at the end where. The little boy protagonist, my 4-year-old insisted he was a little girl because of his haircut. And had a big argument about it. Atreyu, right? He's arguing with the bad wolf guy. And because there's they're in this fantasy land, Fantasia, right? And there's this big storm called the Nothing that's destroying everything. And the wolf is essentially telling the little boy what the nothing is, and it's when people when he Fantasia is the manifestation of all the hopes and dreams of humanity, and when people stop ho stop having dreams and hopes, the nothing is all that's left, and it sweeps away this beautiful land that had been there, right? And he essentially says, when people stop having hopes and dreams, they become easy to control, and the nothing is essentially the force that seeks to exert control on people, right? And it's actually, I mean, it's like a kid's movie with like cheesy 80s special effects, right? But there's something really true there, I think.
For
That,
sure.
if people give in to the despair, right? Like happened to the guy's
Yeah.
horse in the swamp and stuff,
Yeah.
When people give in to despair, I mean, there's that's essentially what happens. You become easier to control. You stop being, having your sovereignty or whatever. And I think that's true at the community level too, or even the national level. It's people sort of communities need to have their hopes and dreams pretty clear. Otherwise, people are going to impose them, impose their hopes and dreams instead on top of them. And the hopes and dreams of people like Klaus Schwab, they've written whole books about them, and it's not very nice sounding. Definitely not the kind of thing anyone else would hope for, anyone normal anyway would hope for the future. So it definitely really is important to stay hopeful and keep planning and creating and going on about your life as normal as normally as you can, because if we sort of act like it's they've taken it and they've won, I mean, it's not a good way to fight back, that's for sure. And you can resist a lot, I think, by just keeping that internal environment as positive and as vibrant as you can, despite all of this crazy stuff going on. It gets increasingly crazy. So anyway, that's my weird little night kid movie inspired anecdote.
I fully agree. Fully endorse that message. Yeah, for sure.
All
Fully
right.
agree.
So, anything else you want to add on what we've talked about so far? I wanted to ask you a little bit about Ukraine, because I know you've been there and done some reporting from there, and of course that's in the news, and we're talking about Russia. So, anything else on the WEF, biometric fourth industrial revolution, Sputnik V side of things that you'd that we didn't get to cover that you'd like to go over?
I think we covered mostly everything. So, guys, Sputnik V is the same scam. It's the same scam. Don't get tricked.
Yeah, well, I really liked your titles on your articles about it. And you're like Sputnik V. It's what oligarchs crave. It certainly seems to sort of
Is though.
fit the
Bankers crave
bill.
it, oligarchs, Klaus Schwab, everybody's craving Sputnik
Yeah,
V.
everyone's
So
clamoring for it. Well, not just for Sputnik V. It's true for Moderna's
everyone.
newly renamed Spikevax, and
Whoa, I didn't
some
hear
of these
about
other
this
ones too.
Spikevax. That
Yeah, well,
sounds
the
good.
FDA fully approved it now. Like, they fully approved Pfizer's. So that's fun. Anyway, I have so much to say about Moderna, but I'll refer people to my series about them instead. Like all 11,000 words of it. Anyway, well, to wrap up here, I wanted to ask you a little bit about Ukraine because obviously there's been a lot of pumping up of the war threat with Ukraine. It looks like they're going to try and start a big proxy war there if they can, similar to what they attempted to do, or rather what we have the Biden administration in the U.S. and it was the Obama administration and with Syria in 2011, right? So this is sort of I guess Biden's own time to sort of do that. What are your thoughts about it? I've only been following it, sort of closely. This is my first podcast back from maternity leave, right? So I was doing a lot of baby stuff, not so much geopolitical
War analysis.
following geopit
Yeah.
right war analysis and all of that up. But I think it's anytime this type of stuff gets hyped up to the degree it is, it's for a reason. So why do you think
Yeah.
this conflict is being hyped up now, especially in the West? It's mainly Western media that's hyping it up. So why do you see them hyping it up, and what do you see happening?
Oh gosh. I mean, it's a tough one. Obviously, just as an observation, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, I took two short trips to Donbass in 2015. This was right after, if I remember correctly, the first Minsk ceasefire agreement was signed, if I remember correctly, first or second. So I want to go with first. Anyway, I've never seen it so I've never seen it the tension so crazy as I have now. And this stuff, you see flare-ups. You see media flare-ups and also diplomatic flare-ups that have been happening pretty regularly, for the last 6 years, So I have to admit that I'm concerned just because I've never seen it so bad as it is right now. And what adds to the concern is that unlike previous times where there were these media reports of, the sort of phantom Russian army like sneaking back and forth across the border, which, the reality is that there's definitely special forces and irregular Russia-linked forces in Donbass, but definitely not like entire battalions of, Russian battalions or whatever they're right. I'm sorry, I'm not a military person, but you know what I'm talking about. So there's not regular Russian army going back and forth between Ukraine and Russia, and that hasn't been happening. But at this point, I mean, the buildup, as far as I can tell, is real. I mean, they're basically moving, Russian troops that are stationed in Russia's eastern district, and bringing them over to Belarus, for example, and it's scary. And why
Well,
they
it's a tit
keep,
for tat thing too, right? Because the U.S. is moving a bunch of troops
for
over to
sure,
Eastern
for
Europe as
sure,
well,
for sure. And and by the way, just to make this very clear, I mean, while I think that obviously there are games within games, I mean, the reality is that NATO has absolutely been acting as the aggressor against Russia for, basically since the fall of the Soviet Union. And there's just no
Well,
way
they've
of
been
getting out.
expanding and breaking that expansion rule like
Exactly.
every
Like
year for,
nonstop breaking this expansion. And so the question, why has it come to a head now? Why now of all times is a really good one. I don't even know if I think I have a good answer. I mean, I could guess. I could say that it's a good distraction for everyone involved because, we basically have mass domestic problems on both sides here. I mean, let's not kid ourselves that in many ways, I mean, a foreign conflict for Russia right now, would have its benefits. It just would. It would drum up patriotism in a really big way. It would basically stomp out any sort of domestic grumblings about QR codes or other COVID-related issues like compulsory vaccination. It would undoubtedly have be very beneficial in many ways for the Russian government. And the same obviously can be said of NATO countries and even of in Ukraine, which has its own very serious domestic political economic issues, probably even more so than Russia does. So why now? I don't know. I mean, maybe you have an idea you can throw around with us, but I could definitely see why it would be appealing, to certain elements of the government.
Yeah, well, I think it's what you described how it would be beneficial to the Russian government is certainly true for the US or the UK, right? Where you have a lot of the COVID narrative is crumbling in big ways. The government's been forced to walk back some big policies like the OSHA mandate in the case of Biden, the mandatory or the planned mandatory vaccination for NHS workers in the UK, things like that. And there's a lot of unhappy people, a lot of pushback, and with things the narrative falling apart. I mean, war is a very handy way to make those things go away, at least in terms of media coverage, right? You know, I was on this podcast with Tim Dillon, I guess a couple of months ago, and I said, and I still think this is true. You know, when narratives that are really important to the global elite. You know, these types of groups, power factions, whatever, start to fall apart. Historically, they take people to war. I don't really know if they're trying to, I don't really think they're trying to go yet for some sort of big, like, nuclear crazy thing between the US and Russia. But would they try to do, you know, a big major proxy war? Yeah, I think it's possible. So hopefully that's not the case. But, you know, the more they feel like, you know, these are technocrats, right? People like Klaus Schwab and Erwin Graf and all of that. The more they feel like they're losing control and losing their ability to manage the population, you know, Schwab and Graf see themselves as managers of the global public, right? Once they feel that slipping, you know, they'll lash out and do something extreme, I think, you know, whether it's that or their big planned cyber attack that the US has always been ready to blame on Russia, but hasn't said anything about Russia co-hosting the cyber attack simulation with the World Economic Forum. That's fine, you know. Oh, it's so nuts. But yeah, a lot of different crazy stuff is definitely it could definitely happen, and you know, that's why it's important to be vigilant. Anyway, I think it's probably close to time to wrap up here. Thanks a lot for your time, Riley. Really appreciate it and going over a lot of issues that really have not gotten the coverage they merit. So, not only thank you for coming on the podcast, but thank you for your work and your articles on this. I would definitely recommend to people to check out your Substack, which, as I mentioned earlier, is edwardslavsquat.substack.com. Is there anywhere else people can follow and support your work?
No, that's it. If you want, you can follow me on Twitter, just Riley Wagaman, but not a social media guru. But yeah, just Edward Slav Squat.
Can't blame you.
Substack.
Ryan Christian from The Last American Vagabond was just booted off the second time from Twitter. I keep expecting it because I have a decent amount of followers on there.
Brutal.
But it hasn't happened yet. We'll see how long I will last. Maybe we can all take bets. But yeah, all right. Well, this was a really, I think, insightful podcast, and you know, definitely covered on a lot of issues that normally don't get talked about a lot. So, for those listening, if you found this episode to be share worthy, please share it around because we are increasingly, just like everyone else in alternative media, experiencing have been for a long time big tech censorship and all of that stuff. So, the more you can help get this info out. The better. Thank you so much to people who support this podcast and especially those who decided to continue supporting while I was on maternity leave. For those that don't know, I had a little boy on New Year's Eve. He is very cute and chubby and adorable. I won't say anything more about him.
Congratulations on that,
But
by the way. That's
thank
great.
you. thanks. But I really appreciate the people that helped support Unlimited Hangout during that period of time. And hopefully you will enjoy this podcast. I guess this is sort of my official announcement that I'm not technically on maternity leave anymore, but will be transitioning back to full-time work over the course of February. But you can expect regular podcasts as the same frequency I was doing before from here on out. So with that being said, thanks so much for listening and catch you all in the next episode.